Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. Our guest today, Dr. Barbara Oakley, didn't begin learning remedial high school algebra until age 26. Now, she's a professor of engineering, a New York Times best-selling author, and instructor of one of the world's most popular massive open online courses, Learning How to Learn, with nearly 2 million registered students. How did this happen? As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living and newest Inside Science programming, we are joined today via Skype with Dr. Barbara Oakley. Dr. Oakley will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates program October 18th at the Baird Auditorium, where she'll use metaphor, analogy, and prime neural circuits to discuss difficult topics. And Dr. Oakley will explain how to learn more effectively, drawing on her experience as both an engineering professor and a linguist, as well as from key research findings in cognitive psychology and neuroscience.
We're going to have a lot of fun that evening. We're going to be learning about behind-the-scenes insights on how the world's largest course on learning how to learn was created and how it's become the 2 million strong Leviathan it's become today. We'll talk about all sorts of insights from neuroscience that can be practically useful in helping you to learn. And those include things like how chunking occurs, how to create these patterns that you can instantly call to mind to become an expert in any subject, and also all sorts of other great insights that you probably haven't been aware of before.
That, of course, was our guest today, Dr. Barbara Oakley, who all welcome to the Not Old Better Show immediately. Well, Dr. Barbara Oakley, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here, Paul.
I'll tell you, it's a pleasure for me, too. This is something I'm personally very interested in. I know my audience is going to be very interested in it. I know the Smithsonian audience on October 18th, 2017 at the Baird Auditorium will be interested in this. But maybe you could start off, Dr. Oakley, by telling us a little bit about your own journey. What brought you to this point in time? And maybe touch on the mind shifts that came for you along the way. You have this really distinctive story that I've learned about, and I think my audience would love to hear that.
Well, I think that my own story is surprisingly paralleled by many people's stories. I think a lot of people end up doing things they never thought they could do. And that's certainly the case for me. I grew up hating math and science. I loathed it. I was terrible at it. I flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science. And it's kind of ironic since I'm today a professor of engineering. So the twist for me was I wanted to learn a language. It wasn't like I was some language superstar as a kid. My family was resolutely monolingual, and you can guess what language they spoke. But I wanted to learn another language. So since at that time there weren't inexpensive college loans available, I enlisted in the Army to go to the Defense Language Institute, which, as it turns out, is one of the world's premier language learning institutions. And I did learn another language. I learned Russian, and I ended up working out at sea on Soviet trawlers as a Russian translator.
And Dr. Oakley, let me interrupt for just a second. I'm sorry, but how you were what, about 26, 20, a little under 30 at this point in your life?
At that time, I was about 25, and I was beginning to realize that, you know, there weren't many other jobs working as a Russian translator. I just kind of had boxed myself in by following my passions. So around age 26, I decided I would try to open my mind and see if I could learn math and science. And I remembered the military officers I'd worked with who seemed to be really smart, and I couldn't quite figure out, was it their training that made them able to solve these problems, or were they naturally smart? Now I know it was their training, actually, that in some sense really did make them smarter. Their ability, their learning help them to learn new things more effectively. So that's why I went back to school at age 26, started with remedial high school math, and worked my way slowly upwards. But if I'd known then what I know now about learning, I could have made it so much easier on myself.
Certainly for my audience, the Smithsonian audience, of course, included, learning, ongoing learning, is an important thing. It does a lot for the brain, but you're suggesting really in your new book, Mind Chef, that learning doesn't have to necessarily stop in life. That as a matter of fact, if you want to learn math, if you want to learn an additional language, some of this can be so beneficial for the brain, and it certainly can happen later in life too.
That's right. Even for me, I was almost 60 years old. And I mean, if you stuffed a camera in my hand and showed me where to press the button, I could take a picture. That's all I knew about anything to do with photography or videography. But I learned how to set up a studio. I made a really super cheap studio and ended up making the world's largest and most popular massive open online course. And I mean, this isn't a tribute to my own smarts. It's a tribute to the fact that anybody can do it. If you just kind of take a look, start really slow, be forgiving of yourself, you can really learn far more and do far more than you ever think you can. And it makes you feel so much better.
This idea, this learning to learn, this course that you've created, this massive open online course, I went online and I looked at it a little bit. I found that there are 2 million students that participate in this course. How did you do that? And what are you now learning about these students to improve their learning?
I think the biggest thing I've been learning is how hungry people are for effective ways of improving their learning. And I love academia. So, I mean, I absolutely love it. But there is that old joke where moving a university is a bit like moving a cemetery. You can't expect any help from the inhabitants. There's this sort of educational inertia that sets in about, well, let's see, when it comes to teaching people about learning, the only people who really are interested in that are teachers and professors. And so we'll just cater all of our teaching to them. But actually, just people are starving for information. They want to learn more, and they want to learn it in a fun way, in a way that helps them to be more effective, and they know darn well it's super helpful for them in the very rapid changing that's going on the job nowadays. So, and then so many parents are really looking for something to help their child to learn more effectively. So when you make this kind of information available for people, they just love it. And I think that was really what was behind the success of the course, which I did with Francis Crick professor at the Salk Institute, Terence Sanowski, who's a legendary neuroscientist. So the course is well-founded on science, but it was so fun to do. You know, we have zombies and all sorts of things. So you never quite know if it's going to be a formal serotonin neurotransmitter discussion or if you're going to, you know, kind of be seeing some metabolic vampire slipping in. And it was a lot of fun to make.
The title of your talk at the Smithsonian again on October 18th is Mind Shift, Learning to Learn. Mind Shift is the name of your book. Your book is going to be available for sale there at the Smithsonian after your talk, and you're going to be there signing it. But let's talk for just a second about this idea of learning to learn. Is it possible to kind of shift the gears of the brain a little bit as you learn and go into different modes of learning? And how do you kind of direct the brain to do that?
Well, you can kind of direct the brain, but the brain, of course, has a bit of a mind of its own. And so part of what happens, I think we often think that we only learn when we're focusing on something. But that's actually not true. There's two very different modes in which the brain operates. So there's focused, formally speaking, task-positive networks. And there's what I call a diffuse mode, which is actually a set of a couple dozen neural resting states, the most prominent of which is the default mode network. And this, so you either are focusing on something and you're really intensely learning it, or you're kind of not thinking about that something at all. You're kind of letting your mind relax and not think about anything particular, and that's the diffuse mode. But during that relaxed time, your default mode network is actually consolidating the information that you've just been focusing on, and it's kind of rearranging it, putting it to order, making sense of it. And that's why when you get really frustrated when you're trying to learn something and you stomp off and, you know, give it a break, and you come back later and you find, oh, wait a minute, this was so easy, why couldn't I understand it before? That's because that diffuse mode was reorganizing and making sense in the background.
As I looked over the book Mind Shift, I noticed this kind of this general tone that you take about, you know, almost commanding yourself to pay attention to something. Is that one of the diffuse modes? And maybe commanding the brain to not pay attention to something, conversely?
It's a bit different in that when you're focusing, you are sometimes commanding your brain to focus on something. Although if it's well-designed material that you're learning, it will actually draw your attention whether you like it or not. But the hard part, I think, of learning is letting go. It's almost like falling asleep is going into this diffuse mode. You can't command your brain to do that. You can set it up so that it will not think of anything in particular. For example, I find that when I go in the shower, it's like my brain knows immediately that I can't sit there and focus on something. So it lets go. And then all of a sudden these ideas will pop in. Or the old saying is the brain, the bath, or the bus. So in other words, I mean, the bed, the bath, or the bus. So you're falling asleep, or you're going for a ride, or you're going for a walk, or you're relaxing in the bathroom or something like that. All of these are good ways to sort of set the stage for that diffuse mode to kind of pop into gear. And that's an important aspect of learning.
And so what's the research behind all of this? And how long does it take to actually do that? Is there kind of a sweet spot, so to speak, to kind of some of this technique?
Oh, this is really a good question. We know that when you begin focusing on something, that it usually takes about 20 minutes for your mind to really get wrapped around that idea and for you to get into the flow of it. So this is why a technique called the Pomodoro technique mm-hmm. can be so helpful, because you set a timer for 25 minutes, you turn off all distractions, you work intently for that time, and then you reward yourself. So it takes advantage of that idea that it takes about 20 minutes to get yourself going. Now, as far as how long should that diffuse break be afterwards, that depends a lot on what you're studying. You may get into the flow while you're focusing and want to keep going after 25 minutes after all. But some people will use a Pomodoro app. They'll download it on their computer or their cell phone or whatever. And you can collect Pomodoros. So in other words, you can do maybe five different 25-minute streaks, but you really want to make sure that you're taking a break after each focus session, because it's a little bit like Pavlov's dogs. when they rang the bell for the dogs, right, and they knew, the dogs knew that there was going to be a reward, they were going to get some food, and so they'd start salivating. They loved it. They were so excited during that period. If you know you're going to get a reward after your period of focusing, you will actually begin to enjoy that period of focusing more. It'll make you happier. And if you suffer from depression or anxiety, you'll find that these periods of focusing actually sort of, in some sense, dampen down that the default mode network that can lead to some of these anxious and depressive thoughts.
Talk a little bit more about that, because depression is something that is very, very important, a reality for my audience, certainly for many. And learning is something that actually can help a little bit with the overcoming of these depressive thoughts and depressive mindsets. How does that work?
I think it works best, and I'll bring up also a new topic here, in conjunction with exercise. And what happens is we now know that when you exercise, it helps produce a chemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. And this factor helps the growth of dendritic spines, which all that translates into, it makes better brain connections. It makes you feel better. You're able to think more thoughts. But what happens is, when you exercise, it helps to make better connections, but it also helps spur the growth of new neurons. And these new neurons help, and we don't really understand how it helps, but they help with depression. It like neurogenesis is a very hot area now in neuroscience, and there is some knowledge of why that takes place, why it helps alleviate depression, but basically getting new neurons helps you to learn new things and also start seeing the world in a better, newer, a more positive way. And so what the 1-2 punch of exercise and learning does is exercise allows new neurons to be born and to begin to thrive, and learning provides like a trellis that allows those new neurons to grow, have something that they're actually growing on and growing for. So between the two of them, exercise and learning new things is a super powerful method to help you tackle depression.
We are here with Dr. Barbara Oakley, well-known author, New York Times best-selling book that's just now out called Mind Shift, Learning to Learn. We've danced around this subject a little bit, Dr. Oakley, but what's the fundamental thesis of your book, Mind Shift?
It is that we can learn and do much more than we think we can, and there are some tools, tips, and tricks that can very much help you with that. So whether you're thinking about a major life change or you're just looking to learn something new that might either enhance your career or enhance your hobbies, there's ways to do that and fit it into your lifestyle that can very much enhance many aspects of your life.
Well, I certainly am learning how to learn today, Dr. Oakley, and thank you. I have a final question for you. Many of my audience are shifting. Maybe they're working towards a shift. They're deciding what they might do for this second act in their life. How do you suggest that come about in order to avoid career ruts and dead ends and really find some of this hidden potential that we all have that we want to explore during this second phase of our lives?
I think the biggest thing is learning about how other people have done similar sorts of things, the kinds of uh, the the tools they've used, the techniques they've used. For example, let's say you want to make a change and you're a little afraid of it. And maybe your family and friends are discouraging you from making some changes. Well, there are ways to kind of circumvent that, either by kind of living a bit of a double life for a while, as some of the people that I profiled did, or you can be a contrarian and kind of charge into it anyway, or just dabble a little bit and work into it gradually. And the great thing is there is really some fantastic new online material. For example, my course with Terry is through a company named Coursera, which works with the top 150 universities and institutions around the world. So it's got terrific courses available, and none of this was available even 10 years ago.
Well, these are all such important items. I know during your talk on October 18th at Baird Auditorium, you're going to be going into some detail of examples of people who have done this effectively, along with more on your course. We'll put up links to the Coursera course that I found, this very popular Learning to Learn. 2 million students enrolled in it, and we'll offer these links on the website. So check out the links on the site for Dr. Oakley, the Smithsonian. There are reserved tickets available for this event. There's a book sale and signing. Dr. Oakley, thank you so much for joining us today. It's just been a pleasure. I'm excited. I've got my ticket for October 18th. I will see you there. So I'm really so pleased to talk to you today. But thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Paul. And I can hardly wait to meet you.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to meeting you too. But thanks so much for joining us today. Thanks to our guest today, Dr. Barbara Oakley, who will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Program October 18th, 2017 at the Baird Auditorium in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Smithsonian Associates and their Inside Science program, along with all their help with the interviews. As usual, we'll post links to everything, and also as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in the feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me email at info@notoldbetter.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all.